The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Oh, boy. All right, it's a Thursday, and it's a sort of a frustrating day. I'm having computer problems again. The gremlins have infiltrated my machine. So we have no YouTube today. Sorry for you video watchers. No YouTube today, but we are streaming live at NicoleSandler.com. Of course, the show now heard from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Voices, Tuesday through Friday. It's one of those days, and it must be that hell has frozen over. Yeah, because George W. Bush gave a speech this morning in New York, maybe it was early this afternoon, and he actually made sense. He was talking big words. He was saying things that, that I agreed with. I found myself nodding my head saying, yeah, who is this guy? That's the thing. Donald Trump is making George W. Bush sound reasonable. Let me play a little bit, a minute or so, of George W. Bush and his takedown of Donald Trump and Trumpism.
At times, it can seem like the forces pulling us apart are stronger than the forces binding us together. Argument turns too easily into animosity. Disagreement escalates into dehumanization. Too often, we judge other groups by their worst examples, while judging ourselves by our best intentions. Forgetting the image of God we should see in each other. We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America. We see a fading confidence in the value of free markets and international trade, forgetting that conflict, instability, and poverty follow in the wake of protectionism.
Yep.
We've seen the return of isolationist sentiments.
Yep.
Forgetting that American security is directly threatened by the chaos and despair of distant places where threats such as terrorism, infectious disease, criminal gangs, and drug trafficking tend to emerge. In all these ways, we need to recall and recover our own identity. Americans have great advantage. To renew our country, we only need to remember our values.
Yeah, values. That's something that the current president, the current occupant of the Oval Office, does not have. Values. No empathy, no values, no intelligence, no common sense. I could go on and on. The one thing that W did not do is name Trump, although he was truly recognizable in his words. Aaron Blake over at Washington Post has a great piece on this speech. He wrote, for the past 9 years, George W. Bush has largely stayed out of presidential politics. He declined to criticize his successor, Barack Obama, and he chose not to endorse but largely ignored President Dumbass. I can't put those two words together. Dump. While Mitt Romney and others spoke out publicly against Trump, Bush stayed above the fray. That changed in a big way Thursday. Speaking at a George W. Bush Institute event in New York, Bush didn't use his name, but his target became clearer as the speech progressed. Here's a sampling. All right, so here's some of what he said. Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seem more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication. Oh, I think I need to get the dinger ready. Yep. We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. Yep. We've seen our discourse degraded by casual cruelty. Argument turns too easily into animosity. It means that bigotry and white supremacy in any form is blasphemy against the American creed, and it means the very identity of our nation depends on passing along civil ideals. Bullying and prejudice in our public life provides permission for cruelty and bigotry. And the only way to pass along civic values is to live up to them. You know, I'm sure W didn't write this because there were an awful lot of big words in that, you know, minute 20 second clip. But the fact that he said them was great. What was missing was Trump's name, because a lot of Republicans have started to use these veiled references to Trump. But for some people to get it, you need to spell it out. Back to Aaron Blake at the Washington Post. Any one of those quotes in isolation could be dismissed as high-flying rhetoric aimed at the general coarsening of our political culture or the rise of forms of nationalism and extremism that clearly exist outside the Oval Office. But almost each of these quotes has some connection to Trump. Conspiracy theories and fabrications? Check and check. Nationalism and nativism? Check. A degraded discourse? Big check. Bigotry and white supremacy? Trump was criticized for not calling them out strongly enough in Charlottesville. Strongly enough? He didn't call them out at all. Bullying? Huge check. Not living up to civic values? Check. Definitely. And then he goes on to write about a speech that John McCain gave earlier this week in which he alluded to spurious nationalism, which we talked about. I played some of it. And then he wrapped up this article by saying, it's possible Bush would argue that Trump is more a symptom of all of these unhealthy trends in American democracy than the root of them. But in drafting a prepared speech like that, he had to know how those words would be perceived. Trump, during the 2016 campaign, repeatedly attacked Bush, most notably blaming him for 9/11, yeah, and for the Iraq War, yeah. Blame deserved. More recently, he has favorably compared his own hurricane response with the response to Hurricane Katrina. That's coming right up, which many view as the worst moment of Bush's tenure. On Thursday, Bush clearly decided that silence was no longer tenable. Here's the thing. He just should have called him out by name. Because speaking of Trump comparing himself favorably to the way Bush handled Katrina, that's what happened today. The governor of Puerto Rico, Roberto Rosello, was in Washington. He met with Trump in the Oval Office. Rosello walked a very fine line of not endorsing what Trump said, but not outright criticizing him either, lest he suffer the wrath that the mayor of San Juan has been suffering. But I just got to play this for you. Donald Trump, you'll hear, is asked by the pool reporter in the Oval Office to grade himself and his administration on their response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico.
Mr. President, between 1 and 10, how would you grade the White House response so far to the hurricane?
I'd say it was a 10.
A 10?
I'd say it was probably the most difficult. When you talk about relief, when you talk about search, when you talk about all of the different levels, and even when you talk about lives saved,
what?
You look at the number. I mean, this was, I think it was worse than Katrina.
It Maybe.
Was in many ways worse than anything people have ever seen. They got hit by a Category 4.
Yes, it grazed, was a Category 4.
But grazed about, you know, a big portion of the island.
Oh, he's
but
talking about
grazed.
Irma now.
The rest of it hit Florida, as you know.
That's Irma.
But that was bad. But then they got hit dead center. If you look at those maps, by a Category 5.
Nope. It was a 4.
Nobody's ever heard of a 5
what?
Hitting land. Usually
what?
By that time, it's dissipated.
No. See, he's such an inane asshole. First of all, it was a Category 4. Maria, when it hit Puerto Rico, was a Category 4, not a Category 5, although Trump keeps saying it was a 5. It was hit dead on. Maria enveloped the entire island. But he said no one's ever seen a Category 5 hit land before? Nonsense. Hurricane Andrew was a Category 5. I believe the mainland U.S. has been hit no less than 3 times by Category 5 hurricanes. So he just talks out of his ass.
It hit right through and kept to a 5.
No, it didn't.
It hit right through the middle of the island, right through the middle of Puerto Rico. There's never been anything like that. I give ourselves a 10. I think that locally there, I really think locally they have, in this gentleman, great leadership. I have to tell you, it's a tough job. But We have provided so much.
You
so
have?
Fast.
Really?
We were actually there before the storm hit. We were there before the first one, before the Category 4 hit. Brock.
That would be Irma, before Irma hit.
Before the storm. We had the Coast Guard waiting for the storm, just outside the storm, and following the storm in. Many lives saved.
Really?
The Coast Guard in Texas saved 16,000 lives. The Coast Guard is incredible.
Okay.
Incredible, the job they've done. But all of the armed forces, what they've done has been Army, Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, all of the goods dropped in, helicopters that weren't even meant for this purpose. All of a sudden, they're delivering food and services. I would give a 10. I would say locally, and I understand locally, a person loses his or her or their house, and then they can't go to work. If you lose your house, you know, it's hard to go and be a policeman.
Except they do it every day. They're doing it in California,
you know,
where the fires are.
Live, frankly. This is what happened. So many people. You read that they had no truck drivers in Puerto Rico. Well, they have a lot of truck drivers in Puerto Rico, but many of them lost their houses. So they had to be with their families.
Or maybe they just had no way to get to the docks to drive the trucks, because the roads were all messed up. Maybe that was it.
Families. So we would have the military driving trucks. They're not supposed to be driving trucks.
Nonsense.
It's not even their aptitude. Some of them didn't really know how to drive trucks, but they learned very quickly. They're smart. But we had the military, in many cases, driving trucks because
it's
not the people's fault. They lost their house. They were devastated.
Oh, my God.
And I think we did a fantastic job.
And there he goes, patting himself on the back for the fantastic job he did. Yeah, he gave himself a 10. Meanwhile, people are dying. They're saying the death toll is probably closer to 450 rather than 45 in Puerto Rico. People do not have drinking water. They don't have food. The relief efforts are anemic at best. And this doofus is there saying, I'll give myself a 10. We did a great job. The military is not supposed to drive trucks. That's not even their aptitude, but they're smart. They learn how to do it quickly. Where does this guy get this shit? He just makes stuff up and spews it out. He just vomits it, projectile vomiting out of his mouth. Oh, my goodness. Well, at least I got a good laugh out of it. I give Governor Roselló of Puerto Rico a lot of credit for being able to sit there with a straight face and not tell him exactly what he thinks of the nonsense he's spewing. Because he knows, look, the only way to get anything out of this guy is to flatter him and cajole him. And he did. Trump a few times said, we did a great job, didn't we? And Roselló answered in very measured terms, things like the response was fast or things like that. He never actually said, yes, you did a great job. But Trump thinks he did. He hears what he wants to hear anyway. Oh, boy. Well, we'll get a little more when we check in with Victoria Jones in a few minutes at the Talk Media News Service. Today's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. I apologize that we are not on YouTube today. The gremlins have taken over my computer, so at least we're streaming audio. So we got that going for us. All right. Quick check of news and then back with more. It's Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The bipartisan deal to shore up the health care exchanges under the Affordable Care Act is still alive, but barely. Senators Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray formally introducing the bill on the Senate floor Thursday, though it's unclear whether it would even be brought up for a vote in either chamber of Congress. The president has both praised the deal as, quote, a very good solution and trashed it as enriching the insurance companies, quote, like nothing anybody has ever seen before. Open enrollment begins on November 1st. Donald Trump continues to deny that he was disrespectful to the family of LaDavid Johnson, a soldier killed in Niger nearly 2 weeks ago. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about the president's contention that he has proof he didn't say what Congressman Frederica Wilson alleged.
What proof does President Trump have when he says Congresswoman Wilson is not telling the truth? Are there recordings of his phone call with Maisha Johnson?
No, but there were several people in the room from the administration that were on the call, including the chief of staff, General John Kelly.
The president also said that he has called every family of someone who's died. Is that true?
The president's made contact with all of the families that have been presented to him through the White House military office.
There have been families that have since come forward in this to the Associated Press. The names are in these reports who say they've not actually heard from this White House in any capacity.
All of the individuals that the president has been presented with through the proper protocol have been contacted through that process.
That's not all the families of soldiers killed since Trump took office, as he claimed. While journalists were fact-checking the president's claims, they came upon one slain soldier's father who accused him of going back on a promise to send a check. Chris Baldridge, the father of Army Corporal Dylan Baldridge, who was killed in June in Afghanistan, told the Washington Post that when Trump called him, he offered him $25,000 and said he would direct his staff to establish an online fundraiser for the family. But Baldridge said it didn't happen. The White House said the check is in the mail. The controversy over what Trump said to the widow of a slain soldier erupted when, during Monday's press conference, he was asked why he hadn't commented on the deaths of four U.S. servicemen killed in Niger some 12 days earlier. Politico obtained a statement of condolence drafted by a staffer at the National Security Council on October 5th, but it was never released. Instead of addressing his silence regarding the ambush, Trump chose to deride former presidents over their practices of calling Gold Star families. At Wednesday's White House press briefing, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked how the White House chief of staff felt about his son's death in Afghanistan being politicized.
Did the president speak to his chief of staff, General John Kelly, before invoking his son's death and what has become a political argument?
I know he's spoken to General Kelly multiple times yesterday and today.
On this very topic. In other words, did General Kelly know he would be raising the issue of his son's memory when talking about
I'm not sure if he knew of that specific comment, but they had certainly spoken about it, and he's aware and they've spoken several times since then.
So can you describe how General Kelly feels about it? Is he comfortable with the way his son's
memory? I think that General Kelly is disgusted by the way that this has been politicized and that the focus has become on the process and not the fact that American lives were lost. I think he's disgusted and frustrated by that. And if he has any anger, it's towards that.
It should be noted that Donald Trump was the one who inserted John Kelly's son's death into the discussion in the first place. The Senate is expected to vote Thursday and Friday on the budget, which must pass before Republicans can move on to the bigger question of tax cuts for the wealthy, or as they're calling it, tax reform. Although it looks like it has the votes needed to pass, it appears Rand Paul is not on board. Lindsey Graham had some criticism of the senator from Kentucky.
I think Senator Paul is trying to find a way to vote no, and he always does. Senator Paul can't vote yes on anything because it's never good enough.
Rand Paul hit back.
Lindsey Graham wouldn't know a conservative if he met one, all right? He's never been a conservative. He's probably a big part of why we have such a massive debt in this country.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in the hot seat at the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, fielding questions on a wide range of topics. There were more contentious exchanges with Senator Al Franken, and a lot of questions went unanswered. In the wake of the president's threat to revoke the broadcast licenses of news outlets who run reports unfavorable to his administration, Senator Amy Klobuchar asked about reporters' First Amendment protections.
This is on freedom of the press. We talked about it at your last hearing, and you said you wanted to look at what was going on with the ongoing regulations. The department now has taken some action, and I'll ask the same question. Will you commit to not putting reporters in jail for doing their jobs?
Well, I don't know that I can make a blanket commitment to that effect, but I would say this. We've not taken any aggressive action against the media at this point, but we have matters that involve the most serious national security issues that put our country at risk, and we will utilize the authorities that we have legally and constitutionally if we have to.
Okay.
Maybe we always try to find an alternative way, as you probably know, Senator
right.
Klobuchar, to directly confronting a media person, but that's not a total blanket protection.
Well, that's chilling.
I got good news.
And that's a bit of What's News for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution. My work is 100% listener-funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. All right, for a bit of more news, we turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service. They're at TalkMediaNews.com. Victoria Jones is on the line today. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
So I hear there are now 12 Republicans who have come out as co-sponsors of the Alexander Murray Affordable Care Act fix.
That is correct. There are, let me see if I can get the numbers correct. There are, I believe, 12 Republicans and a certain number of Democrats, yes. And you've got some fairly conservative Republicans. You've got Chuck Grassley of Iowa, mm-hmm. Richard Burr of North Carolina, Joni Ernst of Iowa, Johnny Isaacson of Georgia. So they're not all, you know, screaming liberals like Bob Walker of Tennessee and John McCain of Arizona.
Right. Lindsey Graham is even in there. Go figure.
Lindsey Graham is in there. And in fact, Lindsey Graham and Lamar Alexander spoke with President Trump last night. And they said that they are trying to get him on board. Now, apparently, Graham says that Trump told him yesterday evening, I want a deal. I want to get something for this money, the bailout, that he calls it, of insurance companies. Right. And Graham responded by explaining that Republicans' bills to repeal and replace Obamacare continued the law's subsidy payments, and he argued that the plan is a bridge to the Obamacare repeal bill he wrote with Bill Cassidy.
Mm-hmm.
And he also said he spoke with White House officials again today and encouraged people to make a deal within the, quote, realm of reason. So Alexander also said it was his fourth call from Trump over the last 10 days. So it's very interesting. You know, it seems as though President Trump doesn't necessarily know what this is.
Right.
Hasn't
got a clue. But he's perfectly fine giving his opinion on it. And he goes from one extreme to the other in the course of, 5 minutes. But he has no clue how any of it works.
Well, he certainly did change his view from his initial support on Tuesday to a repudiation of it in the speech on Tuesday night, and then changes on Wednesday. But today he praised Alexandra Murray. He said, I respect very much the two senators. He said, I love that they're working on it. I want them to be careful with respect to the insurance companies. We will probably like a very short-term solution until we hit the block grants, until that all kicks in. And if they can do something like that, I'm open to it. But that's puzzling to Republicans and infuriating Democrats. Chuck Schumer said today he's for the bill, one day against it the next. We can only hope he comes around and grasps what's in the bill.
Well, hopefully he will. But the thing is, if there are 12 Republican co-sponsors, if you add those 12 to the 48 Democrats, thinking that all the Democrats will be on board, I think they have 12.
They are.
Right. Then there's your 60. So there's your 60 in the Senate. And, then you just have to get Mitch McConnell to bring it to the floor. And then there's the pesky House that has to bring it up and vote on it as well.
Right. And right now, Paul Ryan, the Speaker, has said he believes the Senate, quote, should keep its focus on repeal and replace of Obamacare. So, and yesterday, Ryan's spokesperson said that Ryan did not indicate, let me put it this way, did not indicate that Ryan was going to bring it up.
Wow. Well, but if Trump calls Ryan and said, I want you to bring this up, he would pretty much have to, wouldn't he?
What, Ryan would have to bring it up if the Senate brought it up?
No, if Trump called him and said, I want you to bring it up.
In theory, he would.
Yeah.
In theory, but he's free as the Speaker to do what he likes.
Right. I'm just being really selfish here because I would like to have health insurance still next year.
I agree.
Yeah. So what else is happening? Did you catch any of the little press availability in the Oval Office with old Donald and the governor of Puerto Rico? where Donald gave himself a 10?
Gave himself a 10, that's correct. And he asked the governor of Puerto Rico whether, you know, how he would rate him. And the governor declined to give him a numerical rating. You know, I have to say, I thought the governor of Puerto Rico, in what was probably one of the most difficult situations you can possibly be in as a politician, where you're being put on the spot like that, and you're there, you know, asking for, you know, $4.5 billion from Congress and from the president to put your ravaged territory back together again. I thought he did, really well to say that you responded immediately.
Right. Exactly.
Which, many officials are saying, no, you didn't. But I thought that was a good response. Now, he also said that we want to be treated equally.
Mm-hmm.
And President Trump was asked by reporters or a reporter if he supported Puerto Rico becoming a state, but he didn't reply.
Oh, I thought he said, oh, you're going to get me in trouble or something like that.
Well, he didn't reply about whether he thought Puerto Rico should be a state.
Right, because no one told him what he's supposed to think about that, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know whether that one's come up before.
I don't know either. Look, I don't believe that Trump knew that Puerto Ricans were American citizens before this hurricane hit. I really don't. I have so little confidence in this man. It's just mind-boggling. What's happening with the budget? Have they started voting on that yet?
They've got a Votorama coming up. I don't think they've started voting yet, but they will be voting in the next, certainly within the next 24 hours.
Right.
And Democrats do plan to, hold their feet to the fire as much as they can and put them on the spot with amendments to focus them on the increases to Medicare and Medicaid.
So they get the Votorama because they're doing this through reconciliation. It's a budget bill. They can do it with just 50 votes plus Mike Pence as a tiebreaker if necessary. But they do get this Votorama. They get for a period of whatever 24 hours, they get unlimited amendments. So the Democrats are going to be introducing some, I don't know any particulars. Do you know of any that are coming up?
They have a Votorama because it's a budget.
Right.
So they get to do that. Any particulars? I don't know the particulars of the individuals. I think they have quite a few amendments. Some of them will be that it's going to increase the deficit, and some of them will be to put them on the spot on the Medicare increase and on the Medicaid increase. So there will be specific ones to try to put them, you know, have them on the record that they are okay with those increases, the aim being to embarrass them and wound them in the 2018 elections, those who are up for re-election.
When you say increases, you mean cuts? Cuts to Medicare and Medicaid.
Cuts. Yeah, I meant cuts.
Right, that's what I figured.
I just thought I'd clarify.
Because I never met a Republican who wants to increase funding for Medicare and Medicaid.
No.
All right, and what else? Anything else going on today we need to know about?
Other things going on, yes. Richard Spencer, the white supremacist, is speaking at the University of Florida this afternoon. I'm sure you might be aware of that one.
I am, yes. We have a state of emergency in the state. This is how our governor reacted. Richard Spencer's coming. Oh, we'll have a state of emergency.
Yes. And so, so that's going on. So, also, President George W. Bush gave a speech today.
I played some of it.
It's quite an amazing speech, really. It really is quite an astonishing speech, similar to a speech President Obama's given with some similarities, a little bit of similarities, some of the stuff that John McCain said, but really all his own. And even though he did not mention Trump, he didn't need to mention Trump. He could have done a paint by numbers.
It was very apparent who and what he was talking about, although I would like to have some of these Republicans who are using sort of veiled references to come out and spell it out what they're saying, because some people just aren't getting the message. But
I think anybody who listens to anything that former President George W. Bush said
in this speech
would get that message.
Yeah.
That was abundantly clear.
Yes, it was. It was actually, you know, and it pisses me off because it made me, you know, like respect George W. Bush for giving the speech today.
It's okay to respect him for giving that. It's okay, Nicole.
Okay. All right.
It's okay.
All right. Good. All right.
Okay.
All right.
It's okay. People can be multifaceted.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah.
Even the best of us have multifacets.
Yeah. It's okay.
All right.
Okay. So there's that. And then the other thing that I have for you is in our 1 minute left. You don't want the story about the badger, do you?
The badger?
The badger.
Okay, tell me about the badger.
Okay, so this it was on the front page of the BBC World News website.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, BBC World News website. Badger caught napping in cat bed. So I clicked on it, obviously, and there's a picture of a badger with one eye open in a cat bed in a house in Scotland.
Wow.
And, badger, fully grown badger. And so I read the story, and this badger, and they said the badger came in the house, ate all the cat food, got sleepy, went to sleep in the cat bed.
And let me guess, the badger's name was Goldilocks.
No, there's no name for it. No, they called the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and said, what do? We got a bloody great badger in the house, sleep in our cat bed.
Uh-huh.
And so they came over and they said, they came in through the cat flap. So they said, okay, so here's what we're going to do. So they very gently pulled the cat bed over to the cat flap. And because, you know, badgers can get pretty aggressive. And they opened the cat flap. Badger woke up, said, I'm in the wrong house, and ran out the house, and it all ended happily ever after.
That's good to know. Yeah, I wouldn't know a badger if I tripped over one. I would know it was some kind of animal, but I wouldn't know it was a badger.
Oh, come on. You've read The Wind in the Willows?
I wouldn't recognize a badger.
They're the ones with the stripy faces.
Okay.
I'm going to send you a picture, Nicole.
Okay, you do that. Then I'll recognize the badger. Is it like a beaver?
No.
Okay. I wouldn't recognize a beaver either. So, just me.
I'm just going to send you a picture of baby badgers. They're the cutest things in the world.
I believe you, but I'll look out for the picture. Victoria Jones of the Talk Media News Service at talkmedianews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Nicole.
All right. We'll take a quick, very quick timeout and come back with Howie Klein next. Don't go away.
Can't afford a monthly donation? Is that what's getting you down, Bunky? But maybe you shop on Amazon.com occasionally?
Well, then, just use the NicoleSandler.com Amazon portal, and we'll get a small commission on all your purchases.
But I just bought...
Don't worry, we can't see what you bought.
Just bookmark Amazon through the NicoleSandler.com portal and use it. Every purchase helps Nicole stay on the air.
Are you a multinational corporation hungry for a treat? Well, come on down to Schmucky Chucky's, where you'll personally be seated by Chuck Schumer himself.
So many dishes, and they're all fresh.
You're gonna love our Blue Dog special, the Dino Burger, because we say so.
A good hamburger and french fries.
And every burger comes with a side order of...
grits. I love grits. I love anything with corn. It's corn.
All for only $50,000. Wash it all down with a Dirty Debbie.
9/10 water, 1/10 orange juice. After a week or two, you drink this, it's 200 calories and it's acetic.
And wipe your mouth with a tissue print of Glass-Steagall. For dessert, try our DNC tarts.
Little cookies, tell the quality of that.
Most restaurants give you a mint, but at Schmucky Chucky's, you get complimentary.
Sweet and low.
Who picks up the tab for all this? Find out now with Howie Klein of DownWithTyranny.com on The Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Howie Klein takes a break from his writing at Down With Tyranny and his vetting candidates at Blue America to join us each Thursday. Hi, Howie Klein.
Hello, Nicole. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I've just been writing about a race in Utah, and I was going to just call the candidates, and the phone rang.
Ah, well, good timing then. Glad I caught you before you got on the phone.
Me too.
So in Utah, huh? I remember you. Blue America has endorsed some candidates from Utah in the past. That Utah is a tough sell, isn't it?
It is, but you know, that's because it's very gerrymandered. The biggest county in the district, Salt Lake County, is a Democratic county. I mean, Hillary won that very substantially over Trump, and it's full of Democrats. And what the legislature did is they cut the county up into three districts. Out of the four congressional districts in Utah, three of them have a piece of Salt Lake County. So they've diluted the Democratic vote in that county. If it has over a million people, so they could certainly just have one district that was just all Salt Lake County, and there's no question that would be a big Democratic county. So what's happening, and the reason I'm writing about it now, is because the second district of Utah, which Mia Love is the congresswoman from, that district has a big chunk of the even though it doesn't have any of the city, doesn't have any of Salt Lake City, it has a huge part of the county, and she doesn't win that. When she runs, she loses that county, and that's the biggest part of her district as well. In any case, the mayor of the county, a guy named McAdams, has just decided he's going to run for Congress against her. She's a fairly weak candidate. She's just a sort of a Republican backbencher who does whatever the leadership tells her to do. She's very uninteresting, kind of nothing candidate. So, and he's going to run. I'm trying to figure him out. That's why I was going to call just now. But he kind of sounds like just a real run-of-the-mill Democrat. I could be wrong about that, so I don't want to judge yet. I haven't talked to him. But he doesn't. I looked at his website, and there's no positions, no issue positions. So usually, you know, the DCCC tells their candidates, don't put any issues on your website, or if you have to put something, just be as bland as you can be. Don't get anyone angry. And his website has nothing. Now, maybe that's because he's brand new and he just hasn't put up issues yet. That's a possibility. But on the other hand, there are three other Democrats running in that in the primary for that district. And one of them sounds like he must be a Bernie-crat. In fact, I should mention, they don't have primaries; they have caucuses there, but very well attended caucuses with tens of thousands of people voting. And Bernie not only beat Hillary like 80-20; I mean, he just slaughtered her. But Bernie beat Trump very significantly as well. Like Bernie got far more votes than Trump did. So it could be a winnable race, but the DCCC should understand that if the Democrats voted for Bernie 80-20, they're not going to be very excited if they have a Republican-like candidate running in the district, but that's what they want. They want a Republican-like candidate, but that's going to sort of demotivate a lot of Democrats who would be pretty excited to elect a Democrat.
You know, and that's the problem with the Democratic Party. I saw you wrote a piece up at Down with Tyranny, Howie, that talked about, I guess, a column in The Hill that I did not read, but it was talking about, like, the rosy outlook of the future of the Democratic Party. I'm wondering, what are they looking at? Like, who wrote such a piece?
That article itself that you're talking about, the underlying article from The Hill, was just focusing on two of my friends. I think both of them. One is Randy Bryce from Wisconsin.
Who I do know,
and
right.
And the other is Andrew Gillum.
Who I've never met. Andrew Gillum is running for governor of Florida, and I get his emails, but I don't know him.
Okay, I thought you might. But he's an old friend of mine. I've known him for a decade.
Wow.
So Andrew's a good guy. I mean, he's no Randy Bryce, but he's definitely a good guy. The Florida Democratic establishment is trying to destroy him now with the help of the Florida Republican establishment. But and then Randy is, of course, you've interviewed him on your show. Mm-hmm. And just in case anyone has forgotten, he's the very, very, very progressive Democrat who's running against Paul Ryan. So the article in The Hill that you referred to, which is the underlying article in that part of my story, is about how this is the future of the Democratic Party. Youngish Democrats like Andrew and Randy, who really believe in something, and their point was they're both authentic candidates. They're not manufactured blow-dried candidates. And in fact, let me go into a little bit of a tangent. You may have to remind me where I left off. But the other day, Randy was at a candidates meeting that the DCCC called. And it was a four-day meeting. And he only went for one day because he was in town anyway. He figured he'd amble over there. So he was telling me how everyone in the room was wearing like $1,000 suits.
No.
I did tell you?
No. Uh-uh.
Oh, everyone in the room was all other candidates wearing these $1,000 suits and, you know, $400 Gucci shoes and stuff and blow-dried hair. They all look, you know, really, you know, they look like Congress people, actually. And they're there. And then Randy comes walking in jeans and work boots. and I mean, he didn't mean to embarrass
right.
anybody or anything, let alone himself. But that's who he is.
Right.
That's Randy. That's, I mean, you know, I went with him the other few weeks ago to an event that someone threw for him. And it was the same thing. Everybody was like dressed to the nines. And there was Randy in his jeans and work boots. He is what he is. I mean, that's who Randy is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not going to change. And you know, it's part of why people love him so much. The quarterly numbers just came out for fundraising. And Randy outraised every single Democrat that's running. In fact, he outraised everybody, every challenger, regardless of party,
wow.
who's running. And his average contribution was like I think to like $21 or $22. So he's not raising money from rich corporations. He doesn't take money from corporations. He's not raising that kind of money. He's raising small dollar donations. And the reason people are so excited about Randy is because of that authenticity. And that's why the guy who wrote that story in The Hill, that's what he was talking about, that Randy is authentic and that Andrew Gillum is authentic. That was that was his point, that they're not, you know, these, you know, manufactured candidates by the political establishment. So I enjoyed the fact that they're all optimistic and they're saying that's the future of the Democratic Party. But the point of me writing it wasn't that bullshit. The reason I was writing it was to say, let's be real, folks, and look at who the Democratic Party is putting up for leadership. They've picked the single most corrupt Democrat in the entire House of Representatives, Joe Crowley, to be the leader after Nancy and Hoyer are gone. So you can't get worse than him. He's the single worst. Then in terms of corruption, he's just Mr. Corruption. And then when they looked for their Senate candidates from the House, Schumer picked two really bad candidates, one of whom is Kyrsten Sinema, who votes for the Republicans more than any other Democrat in the House. She's basically a Republican something like about 80% of the time.
Wow.
And the rest of the time she's a Democrat. So 80% Republican, and that's who he decided to pick to run in Arizona, which they think is the most winnable seat that's coming up in 2018, the most winnable Senate seat.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm really happy that Randy and Andrew are running for Congress and for governor. That's great, and that's definitely going to be a part of the Democratic Party. But let's not fool ourselves. The Democratic Party is a piece of shit. I hope I didn't just say something.
Nope,
you can bleep that out.
You're allowed to say that here.
Okay, and you get people like Chuck Schumer, you know, who by the way yesterday was warning Democrats not to fight too hard for gun control because it was a politically toxic issue.
Oh my God!
And in the light of the latest, you know, mass murder spree, the Democrats shouldn't go out on a limb fighting for something like that.
Amazing.
I mean, who wants leaders like that? Today, Nancy Pelosi was quoted as saying that wouldn't it be great if Mitt Romney was president?
What?
Yeah. I mean, come on, give me a break.
He'd be better than Donald Trump.
There are ways to say that Mitt Romney is better than Trump.
Right.
But saying that wouldn't it be great if he was president
no.
is not the way to say it.
No, not at all. Yeah, Nancy's losing it a little bit. So this thing where they picked Joe Crowley to be their successor, was this like a formal vote or how did this happen?
No, they don't do it that way with formal votes. It's a very arcane system of how that happens. of how they move someone up in the ranks and what they do and how they put them in position to influence other people. Now, they can't technically pick their successor.
Right.
There will be a vote, and that decision will be made, but the decision never goes against the establishment.
Right.
He's a candidate. The most likely person I've heard from members of Congress to challenge him would be Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Oh, God.
I mean, right. I mean, give me a break. Like, who do you want to vote for, Godzilla or Mothra?
Right. Yeah, that's a bit pretty sad choices there. Oh, boy. Yeah, not very good. There has been noise, though, from some of the usual suspects, though, that they're not happy with Nancy Pelosi saying that, you know, she'd want to be speaker again if the Democrats take back the House in 2018. Linda Sanchez, who is not a progressive by any means, right? And who's the other one who, from Ohio?
Kind of progressive. Linda is a little, Linda's kind of progressive. She's not ultra progressive, but she's definitely more progressive than she is conservative. Absolutely
okay.
more.
Good to
and
know.
She's smart. I mean, people mix her up with her sister, Loretta.
Oh, maybe that's what I was
Loretta
doing.
Loretta Sanchez is a blue dog. She's very, very, very conservative. She's not in Congress now. But it was always kind of the joke always was, Linda is the kind of intellectual. She's smart. She's progressive. But she's kind of dumpy, whereas Loretta was supposed to be, you know, this hot mama, and, you know, people consider her really beautiful. I don't see it, but people say that about her. But she is kind of stupid and very right wing.
Ah.
Always the thing about those two sisters, which who represent two Orange County districts that are, you know, very Democratic. But when I have to give Loretta, the blue dog, props, when she came in, she beat Bob Dornan. Remember him?
Oh, sure.
B1 Bob?
Oh, yes.
He was the Tea Party before there was a Tea Party, and she beat him in a Republican. The district was Republican then. It's not anymore. A Republican couldn't win that district now. It's very, very Democratic. It changed demographically. There are so many Mexican Americans in the district now that it would be very, very hard for a Republican to put up any kind of a battle. In fact, the Republicans no longer even get on the ballot in that district.
Wow.
And now what happens is that it'll always be two Democrats, because we have a jungle primary situation
right.
in California. So if two Democrats run and a Republican runs, the two Democrats will come in first and the Republican will come in third. And then in the general election, there'll just be a Democrat versus Democrat. That's what happened last time, and that's probably what will happen from now on.
Okay. So anyway, Linda Sanchez was making noise that, you know, she wanted to not necessarily have her challenge Nancy Pelosi, but that it was time for new blood at the top of the leadership in the Democratic Party, which it is, but
yes.
not the Joe Crowley type.
No, not the Joe Crowley type, exactly. And there are some people that say that Crowley put her up to it.
Oh, although really?
He would deny that, of course.
Yeah, but would she, I mean, it sounds like she wouldn't listen to him anyway.
No, because if Crowley becomes number one, guess who becomes number two?
Oh, because she is a vice chair. Right. I see. Okay.
Yes. No, I mean, people in Congress have told me that it was Crowley who told her to do that. And he denies that vehemently.
Interesting. There was more news out this morning that it looks like Republicans are jumping ship, like they're jumping off the sinking ship. Pat Taiburi, I don't even know him,
he's one of these guys who's very, very powerful, but no one knows him except, you know, in Ohio they know him. So Pat, I don't know how you pronounce his name either. I always say Taiburi, but
Taiburi.
It could be Taiburi. I don't know how you say his name. But he's got a district, another one of these ultra gerrymandered districts. So it's one of the most swing districts in Ohio. But you just look at the boundaries and you say, oh, what's that indentation that's not in the district? Oh, yes, a place where black people live. I get it. So they've managed to, you know, create a pretty safe Republican district in the middle of middle of Ohio. Franklin County is where Columbus is, which is a very Democratic area.
Mm-hmm.
And they've managed to just go in and out and in and out and all around to just get catch every Republican vote they can and keep it as a Republican district. That said, it's still winnable by a Democrat. Difficult, but possibly winnable. So, you know, okay, so Tiberi, let's call him Pat, okay?
Okay, okay.
So Pat is, the reason he's so powerful is on the House Ways and Means Committee. And he was one of John Boehner's top lieutenants.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, he had the power of the speaker behind him all these years. And he was definitely destined to be the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, which is very, very powerful. So when Boehner was out, suddenly his power went down a bit, although he's, you know, kind of allied himself with Ryan. But what happened was, even though he was up to be chairman of the committee, of the House Ways and Means Committee, the Texans went to Ryan and they said, hey, you want our support and you need our support. We want that committee. And Ryan buckled and skipped over Pat and gave it to this guy Brady, who's much more conservative and crazy. And the Republicans were very happy. Ryan gave a number of Republicans who didn't have the seniority committee chairmanships to win them over. Now, Pat is the head of the sort of the mainstream Republicans in the House. He just became chairman of their caucus. So, you know, he's by no means a moderate, but he's not you know, any kind of a neo-Nazi or a
right.
fascist.
He's
like,
not a Roy Moore.
He's right. A mainstream conservative is what he is. The only reason that he's well known to me is because every time I look up who's taking the most bribes from various parts, you know, whether, you know, Wall Street, say, you know, who's getting the biggest bribes, and it'll always be Ryan on top, and the majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, will be second, and so it's always the very powerful Republicans who get the giant money, and then some big shot Democrats as well, but you always, always, always see Pat on that list, like he's the sixth biggest contributions from Wall Street of anyone in Congress, anyone in the House. So that's how I have come to know him, because no matter when and no matter what corrupt group I'm looking at, he's always on the list of getting this big money. And then you think, wow, this guy has got to be very powerful. I mean, there's 435 members of Congress. Why is he always in the top 10 when it comes to big money? And you don't hear much about him.
Right.
But underneath it, he's very, very powerful. In fact, on House Ways and Means Committee, he's the chairman of the subcommittee on health care.
Oh, wow.
So anytime the Republicans are putting out any of these horrible health care bills, his hand is in that.
All right. So this
anyway,
morning.
That's who he is. He announced this morning not just that he's not going to run again, which he's not, he decided, but that he's going to retire I think he said January. So that means there'll be a special election to finish out the rest of his term. So I'm very interested to know, and I'm trying to find out, if it's possible for a Democrat to win. So the guy who ran last time is a guy named Albertson. So Albertson did around 30% of the vote. So that's pretty bad. But when I looked at it, what shocked me is he got 111,000 votes. And then I was thinking, 111,000 votes, that's pretty good, considering that Pat spent millions of dollars and Albertson, who was not supported by the DCCC at all, they ignored the race completely, he only raised $28,000.
Oh, wow.
So the one guy was spending millions. I think he raised $5 million for the race. He didn't spend it all, but he raised $5 million, whereas Albertson only raised 28 grand. DCCC ignored the race completely, and this guy still got 111,000 votes. And I know that all – you know how I always complain about all these shitty blue dogs, and we think, how do these guys win all the time?
Yeah.
They got way less votes than he did.
Right.
They just happen to be in low turnout districts. Like, you know, some of them, like Jim Costa, for example, here in California, one of the worst members of Congress, He won last year with 70,000 votes. And that's who the Democrats support. They were happy to, you know, pump money into him whenever it's needed. Whereas the other and these districts have the same number of people, by the way. In every district in the country, they don't have exactly the same number of people, but they all have around 711,000. That's the average. And none of them vary very much from that. It's all around that number. So, you know, you say, well, here this guy, Albertson, running against Pat, got 111,000 votes, and here you have all these, you know, Blue Dog members of Congress who only got, like, you know, less than 100,000 votes, 70,000, 68,000, numbers like that, in districts where they where turnout is not encouraged. So then, of course, the question that's really important, though, is can he win a special election in this environment where Trump is so hated and so many Americans are just like nauseated by him? And you know, there was a headline yesterday that said that the White House was trying to decide if Trump's visit to South Korea should include him going to the demilitarized zone on the North Korean border.
Right.
And I, you know, I did some kind of, you know, cutie tweet about that, saying that would unite every American in prayer. Of course, they would be praying for different things. About a third of Americans would be praying for Trump's safety, and the rest of the country would be praying that Kim Jong-un decides to do the world a favor and get rid of this guy.
Right.
But I can't imagine. I mean, Trump is very well known as a physical coward and has been his entire life. So it's inconceivable to me that no matter what the White House decides,
he's
going to go to the demilitarized zone. I just can't see that happening.
I don't see it either. I don't see it.
So anyway, Pat will be gone, and hopefully by next week I will have talked to Mr. Albertson and can give you a better idea about who he is, what he stands for. I mean, I looked at his website. He, you know, usually the giveaway is on these websites this year is how close they adhere to the stuff that Bernie Sanders talks about. And when they, you know, when they're using his words and they're talking about free public education and talking about Medicare for all, and those kinds of issues, and then you know that their chances are they're a progressive. You have to go further than that, but that gives you a good indication. Whereas the Democrats who make a point of not listing issues or who get on and talk about how great Obamacare is, and you know, I was just in fact. Who was it? One of the people who's running in Utah that I was looking at her her website, and she's trying to convince people that Obamacare is great, and the way she's doing it is by saying it was introduced by the Heritage Foundation. It's really good, solid conservative policy, and we should be for that.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, so you can read a website and get an idea about where a candidate is coming from, even if they don't mean to communicate that. But it gives you a little bit of an idea of who they are and what they stand for.
Right. You know, Dana Steele was on the show again yesterday because the first time I had her on, it was right between her Hurricane Harvey and my Hurricane Irma. And we only spoke for about 10 minutes. So I had her on for a longer segment yesterday. And her website for, you know, a good 6 or 8 weeks was all hurricane relief stuff. And she finally took that down. And it's a very bare bones website. So she needs to get on it and put you know, some issues up there. But the response to her appearance on the show was great. You know, when you were talking about Randy Bryce going into that meeting, you know, wearing jeans, and that's what Dana said. She's driving around the district in a truck, in a pickup truck, and she wears jeans and cowboy boots, and she's a fifth generation Texan, which I didn't realize. And she's in it for the right reasons.
Yeah, I think she is too. I like her a lot. She's in an extremely difficult district. I mean, you know, she's putting up a good fight. She's got a shot because it's an extraordinary, she's got an extraordinary circumstances that everyone in that district grew up listening to her on the radio.
Right.
She's on the biggest radio station in Houston. So even though they're most of the district are a bunch of right wing insane people, they love her music. And, you know, she was known, as I've said before, as the first lady of rock and roll. So for that district, she's the first lady of rock and roll, and damn, she's a Democrat. Woo, who knew that?
Right. And she said so
she
people,
may wind up getting votes anyway.
Right. And she said people are now coming out like, ooh, they don't have to be ashamed. It's like, you're a Democrat? I didn't realize. And, you know, it's, oh, it's okay.
On the other hand, as great as she is, I just want to remind people, part of this district is Jasper, Texas. So that's where they chained that black guy up to the back of a pickup truck and dragged him to his death.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's an uphill battle for her there. Howie Klein, we are out of time. As always, it's great talking to you. Thanks for your input, and we'll do it again next week.
Talk to you next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Howie. Bye-bye. And with that, we are done for the day. Tomorrow, Frank Schaefer will be here. We'll talk about his road trip and his brand new book, too. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow.